Welcome to another episode of Don't Trust Jack. Excuse me, Don't Believe Jack. Here is your host, Jack Michel.
Hey, what's going on? How's it going? And this is a special episode dedicated to... The intro was totally unpolished. I was debating between the rebranded name Don't Believe Jack and Don't Trust Jack for a long time, but Don't Believe Jack has more spiritual connotations for me, so I went with that. But it is a good name, I believe. It has good portents for it in the future. And that is my friend, King T'Challa. He just decided to drop in and, you know, give his two cents on this podcast. This is a very special episode of the podcast, because it is the first it is the first Don't Believe Jack book report. First of all, it's the first episode of Don't Believe Jack, but it's also the first book report. I've been toying with this idea that I want to do book reports about different things, because I'm a fucking nerd. And yeah, we're going to do one. So the first one is today, and it's about this book called 10 Reasons to Delete Your Social Media Account Right Now by Jaron Lanier. Pretty interesting book. Fun. I really loved it. It made a big impression on me. I saw it. I guess I should talk about how we met. You know, because I think behind every book, there's actually a meet-cute story. And the story was that I think I went to a movie using MoviePass at the Los Feliz 3, and right next door is Skylight Books. And after I left the movie, I didn't want to go home yet, but I couldn't stay there because they were sweeping out all the popcorn on my feet. And so I went next door to Skylight Books, and a book, something, you know, some kind of book reading was ending. and I went... And I just saw this book, and I thought it was, and I started flipping through it, and I was like, oh, holy shit, this is totally on point with everything that I feel right now. You know, I probably could teach me a lot. And also Jaron Lanier is just like an interesting guy. He's like a futurist. I don't exactly know his backstory. He's like a futurist of some sort. He oftentimes comments on technology issues and writes about them. He's a white guy with dreadlocks, which makes me not trust him. I'm going to be totally honest. White guy with dreadlocks, I don't trust him on anything but an African drum. And I did not expect that I would be talking about his dreadlocks. But yeah, I mean, you know, I'm a little suspicious. It's I sort of have that rule. It's like, don't trust anyone over 30. Don't trust anyone white with dreadlocks. Just please, for your own sake and for theirs, actually. It's like giving trust to a white person with dreadlocks is like feeding birds. Don't do it. Don't do it. Don't take him to the zoo. It'll just make things worse. They have to be able to fend for themselves. You're taking them out of their natural state if you listen to them. It's like squirrels, you know, that won't be able to survive harsh winters if you validate them. The title is 10 Arguments for Deleting Your Social Media Accounts Right Now. And I don't know. It's interesting. Jaron Lanier has wrote a couple different books about, you know, he's written a book called Super Intelligence, and he's written a book called Who Owns the Future? I'm a little geeked up for these friggin' books. Let's see what Jaron Lanier's background is. I just like making that noise with my throat. Jaron Lanier is a American computer philosophy writer, a computer scientist, and a visual artist. Not going to count his classical music because I haven't heard it yet. And but he does that too. He works on virtual reality. He works at Microsoft Research as an interdisciplinary scientist. He looks like a member of that group. He looks like a member of Korn. I'm looks matter and I'm a piece of shit, and I'm very superficial. So yeah, but he's just a super interesting guy, and he's sold companies to Google and has done all this stuff, and he worked at Atari Labs, which gives me mad respect because anything associated with Atari, you know, I mean, the only thing, if he made the game Bonk, I would try to get adopted by him, and I just you know, anything with an Atari to me is good in my books. I guess it's right. An Atari, I think, did have a VR feature, so maybe he worked on that. But anyways, yeah, he's a sort of a futurist guy, really interesting. This book was wonderful. I picked it up, and it explained so much stuff to me in my life. So not only will I be talking about the book, but I'll also just be talking about stuff in my life, and we're just gonna hop right into it. Stuff in my life, and meet my life, and you really have to stop making those Borat references. They are very played out. Okay, T'Challa. Thank you. Duly noted. Okay, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to fall into that. I'm just going to start talking about this god dang book, okay? And if you got a problem with it, you go take that to the federal government because it is outside of the bounds. They're limited by the Constitution from me talking. Okay, so Jerome Lanier's 10 arguments for deleting your social media accounts. What I really loved about this book, you see, is that what I really loved about this book, honestly, is it's just the fact that it explains sort of the modern world, especially for me. I feel like being in LA and being around comedy, like the way people are caustic. But even in my workplace, when I worked for a company, just the ways that people are sort of roll around with a lot of like anger and shit. And it explains the couple things just at the top that really impressed me about this book. First of all, I felt like it explained why people were increasingly becoming an asshole, even if you agreed with them. It explained, basically the social media through the lens of addiction and behavior modification and operant conditioning as discovered by B.F. Skinner. So basically the psychological component to what social media does to us. It also explained a little bit more about the way that everything on social media is individualized, and so in that way it also separates and isolates us from one another. It also explains how really the imperatives of the people who run social media and collect data on us, their economic relationships. How their economic relationships work, and I'll get into that in the book report, and actually how social media politics that you're sympathetic to could actually undermine progress in an interesting way. So I guess those are the big things. I think some of the pitfalls were, I think the last chapter I was not as convinced by it. You can even hear it in this lazy yawn. He tries to make a big argument about, you know, what the value system is behind social media, and I'm not totally convinced about it. I'm also not totally convinced, and I guess I get it. He wrote this book in 2018, so, you know, he's just sort of is staking a claim, but, and I'll get into this later, my disagreements with, you know, there is a question of whether maybe social media is a net, it still is a net good in our society, and it's a net good for social progress and social change, even if it generates all these assholes and all these problems. But I also have my own thoughts about how to contend with that. And I will say that my main way is to say, my main overall conclusion is that I think, I disagree with him in the sense that maybe social media is undermining activism. I think in the grand scheme of things, it is enhancing it, but we'll see. I mean, you know, the story is never over, so in that way, there are some limitations to the conclusions that can be drawn. But you know, like, I mean, right now it's September 2018, and you know, and like Me Too movement, you know, with some bad parts, but with a lot of good parts, it's rolling and it is doing positive things and allowing people to connect and organize. It certainly is incentivizing journalists to realize that this is a story worth covering, and then they do good, thorough journalism, and then, you know, they find something. So in that way, social media is not the end-all, be-all, but it certainly can creates a heat map for journalism in a good way. It also creates a heat map for journalism in a bad way, and he gets into that too. And I actually totally 100% believe that it creates, it incentivizes bad things in journalism. It also has incentivized some good things, like the Me Too thing. I think Colin Kaepernick, like, you know, I don't think that kind of thing could have happened without social media continuing to agitate around it. So it'll be interesting to see if that can actually change things. Or, I mean, to be totally fucking honest, it also might just fucking make things worse, because obviously there's a big anti-Kaepernick social media presence. But again, I'll get into that later in this book report.
Get going, Jack. Don't waste your time. They don't want to hear you talk. They want to hear the ideas that you've read in the book.
So anyways, he reports it as basically 10 arguments. And it's basically his core argument is that, you know, if you could say there's a core argument, and I actually think this is a really funny core argument, is that, like, this is all about being, you know, like, the main thing that social media undermines is your individuality. That you become trained, right? I mean, essentially, like I said, the core of this book is the idea of operant conditioning, addictive behavior around social media, and basically saying, you know, you are losing your free will. So you know, I'll just go through his rules. But basically, you know, he talks about this idea that, like, you know, everyone loves dogs, you know, rappers even just constantly rap about bitches. So everyone loves dogs, but what we all really want to be are cats. We all want to be like individuals with our own thoughts and feelings and perspectives on things, our own capacity for kindness. You know, one of the things that is interesting is, right, like, in some ways we're like, oh, we want to be part of the pack. But the thing is, what about the pack is super angry and they're acting like assholes all the time? Well, then we become assholes. So, you know, it's not as if being a dog is all about being sweet, you know. Sometimes it's about being feral and ferocious if everyone around you is being feral and ferocious. So, you know, you're not making decisions for yourself. You're essentially being conditioned over time in what, you know, can be referred to gently as behavior modification. So we'll get into that. But basically, yeah, this is, you know, his sort of core metaphor is that everyone loves dogs, but people respect cats. And we all want to be cats. Remember, cats were really big when jazz was big. In the 70s, everyone wanted to be a cat. You call your friends cats. Now you call your friends dogs. Interesting. Is it a conspiracy? No, it isn't. I was just inferring that. Okay, so the first rule, as I said, 10 arguments. These are arguments. So the first argument is you are losing your free will. And basically the core idea in that is that he's basically saying that you know, algorithms on social media are designed to maximize engagement. And what engagement mean, right, essentially is they've designed the social media experience so you keep coming back, which is engagement, that you keep clicking on the pages, that you keep responding to people and connecting with people. And, you know, obviously as part of that, you keep looking at ads. You keep looking at ads that run against these pages, right? And the way that social media places basically maximize your engagement is they try to, you know, data scientists experiment with ways to get you to keep coming back to the web pages. So it's essentially behavior modification. And obviously the flip side of the behavior modification is, you know, encouraging addictive patterns where you have to keep coming back to social media all the time. He talks about short-term dopamine-driven feedback loops. You know, so the idea is, right, every time you pick up, I mean, I noticed that I had this pattern where every time I picked up my phone, I would get a hit of, like, I'd get, like, a little bit of, like, buzz of calm. And I remember, like, when I first quit my office job and started working for myself, I would have my phone on the couch, and I would be at my desk. And sometimes I would get up, and I would go over to my couch and just turn over my phone just to look at it. And then I would put it down, and then I would go back to my desk. And I was like, what the fuck am I doing? Like, I have work to do. Like, I don't get why I'm getting up and just looking at my phone and then putting it down. And I realized that I didn't like being at my job. And so, everyone at my job was constantly on their phones because no one actually wanted to be there. And it wasn't a big deal to look at your phone when you're at a job because you're just taking time away from doing activities you don't like, right? And the idea is like, well, I have to be at this job from like 8 to 5. So why not steal a little bit of time? But then when I started working for myself, I realized, oh, when I'm looking at my phone, I'm just stealing time from myself. So I think one of the more interesting things, he didn't get into this, but the idea that like, I just think it's sort of interesting that like, I think part of the main reason we're addicted to our phones is because we're at jobs where we have downtime where we don't want to devote that to I don't know, working more or interacting with coworkers or something like that. Like I think if it wasn't for jobs where we were stressed, we either don't like them and we're looking for ways to kill time, or we're super stressed and we're looking at our phones to try to mitigate that stress and try to be connected with other people. Phones would not be nearly as powerful, because if you spend like 8 or 9 hours a day like flicking through your phone periodically, then like even when you're out of work, you'll just look at it. And I think it's totally a conditioning thing. And I had to literally deprogram myself from looking at my phone all the time. And I've noticed that if I'm stressed now, I'll still pick it up and do that thing where I will literally turn it over and just look at it and then put it and then turn it back down on its face and put it back down. And it's not like I even, you know, like care about what's on it. It's like a self-soothing thing, you know? So I don't know. I just think phones are like interesting how they do have these addictive patterns, at least for me. But basically, you know, just going back to what he's talking about, it's the idea that like, yeah, right. It's a conditioning thing. So if you start to associate Facebook with, oh, I get to hang out with people and I get this connection and it feels relaxing, then the idea is you keep going to Facebook for that feeling, right? Or, you know, if you get these intense emotions from being on Facebook, you get into arguments with people, you'll keep coming back for it. And intentionally, the people who run social media, I mean, we're talking about Facebook, Google, people who run these programs, specifically Facebook, and then things like Twitter, Instagram, those are, I guess, some big front-facing social media, and then Google is sort of more in the background, is that they realize that you have this relationship with social media, and this relationship with social media will sort of naturally occur, right? Because, oh, social media is a place to be connected, it's a place to be stimulated, exchange ideas, people get into arguments. Well, even if someone gets into an argument with you, and you don't like it, you'll have to fight back, and so you'll spend more time on social media. And basically, right, what they realized over time is that, you know, each of these companies has an army of data scientists, and these data scientists' job is to basically study your behavior and figure out how to get you to use social media more, because the more you use social media, the more you're looking at their pages. The more you're looking at their pages, the more they can sell space to advertisers. Also, if they can identify what kind of person you are, then they can give you targeted advertising, which is worth more money. It's like in the same way that, you know, there are probably only so many people who read travel magazines, but there's an assumption, like travel magazines probably have a much lower circulation than, say, sports magazines. But travel magazines generally, or you know, maybe a tennis magazine, has probably a pretty low circulation, but it caters to the understanding is that it probably caters to very wealthy individuals. So they can run ads for, you know, luxury watches or luxury vacations. People who are in tennis will travel to New York or travel to the UK to go see Wimbledon. So they're high net worth individuals, and again, that's very valuable. So if you can target a group of people who are into tennis, you can infer things about them. And those ads can sell for a lot more than the ads you would sell in, say, USA Today. So it's also about trying to figure out, get people into sort of cohorts of individuals by demographic and wealth and different things. So you're trying to identify these individuals. And I'll get more into that later. But basically, you know, they're trying to figure out ways to maximize engagement. And at its core, what he basically says is that, you know, social media brings up all these pressures, social pressure for status, social pressure to judge other people, to compete with other people, the classic way that people bully other people to avoid being bullied by someone else. All these behaviors come up on social media, and they feed engagement. They're the tools to maximize engagement. Social media doesn't necessarily endorse, status chasing or judgment or competition. In fact, you know, Jaron Lanier points out that actually probably a lot of people who work for social media companies and data companies are probably actually deeply utopian. You know, they've got the product of, and I know some of these people. Some of these people are my friends and very, very intelligent people, very articulate, maybe not idealistic, but they have a value system. However, the cheapest way to get engagement in social media is by making people angry. He basically says, in short, negative feedback is cheap. So it's going to be used a lot. People use negative feedback all the time. And I think about this in stand-up, or I think about this in politics, right? It's a great example. It's like, if you want to get your voters out, you talk about how, like abortion is a great example. It's like, if you want to get your voters out, the thing to do is to scare them that they're going to, take away Roe v. Wade. Or on the other side, if you're like an anti-abortion person, you're going to say that they're going to make everyone get abortions. I don't know. They're going to say some crazy shit. Like, the idea is, like, if you scare your people, then they'll show up. People respond to fear much more than, economics even shows that people feel losses much more significantly than they feel gains. So if you lost $100, you're going to feel a lot more pain than the pleasure you feel if you gain $100. We're just wired that way. We're wired to minimize loss. It's a neurological thing in us, likely evolutionary. And so loss and negative feedback and fear overrides our other systems in our brain. Social media can exploit that. It's not that they want to make social media a negative space, but there's more engagement in making social media negative. And therefore, that's the tool they're going to use. This is unfortunate, he points out, because if you want to, and this is just quoting him, and I love this quote, if you want to motivate high value and creative outcomes, reward and punishment aren't the right tools at all. If we want creativity, we need to foster joy, intellectual challenge, individuality, curiosity, and other qualities that don't fit into a chart. And that's not what's going on, right? We're using reward and punishment on social media with, like I said, status, friendship, things like that. And I feel that personally. I felt like the more I spent time on social media and the more I engaged with it, I thought I was getting something out of it, but I feel like I was actually becoming less creative and less connected with myself because I was more trying to figure out what other people wanted, what other people would like or appreciate or enjoy or, give me props for. And I became really, really uninteresting and, not particularly happy and particularly angry. he talks about the idea that this is the point of what the data scientists do, is to maximize engagement, and, the tool is negativity. And they're basically building this digital advertising empire. Argument number two is that quitting social media is a finely targeted way to resist the insanity of our times. He talks about this idea of the bummer machine, which is, he has like an acronym for it. It's pretty fun, but a few of the components of it are attention acquisition leading to asshole supremacy. On social media, the main reward, the main commodity is attention. Social media is reduced to a competition for attention and mind games. There isn't any real objective You know, we thought that, that's one of the cool things about social media is actually that, there's no objective for it. But one of the, you know, and you know, there's almost something utopian about that. Well, people can project their own objectives onto it. But the thing is, a lot of times people's objectives are crazy. People's objectives are to be assholes to one another, or their objectives are just attention. So one of the more interesting things is he makes, and I think he gets into this later, but I think it's one of the interesting points is he contrasts a Facebook with LinkedIn. And one of the reasons he really likes LinkedIn is because people go on LinkedIn with an objective that isn't just getting attention. It's that you want to get fit with the right job. It has a way of making money that isn't just based on selling ads. In fact, I don't think I've ever, I mean, I've seen soft ads on, you know, like you see things through universities or a training program you get to, you know, improve your credentials. But you don't see like just random ads for like, I don't know, like some shoes you looked up and the ads following you around. You don't really see that on LinkedIn because LinkedIn has a different economic model that isn't, it's built on connecting employers with the right people. It's not built on, you know, other stuff. It's built on, and the idea is everyone's going on with a very clear objective of, I'm trying to get a job. I'm trying to network. I'm sort of have this economic motive, and this economic motive actually makes everything very tame because you're not going to be an asshole on LinkedIn because you're not competing for attention. And competitions for attention make people into jerks. And again, I thought that was a really interesting point because again, I could relate to that. Where, you know, in stand-up, for example, a lot of times I feel like I've, you know, made arguments or done stuff on stage. And it's not because I really believed in it, but just because I'm trying to get attention, because I'm trying to get something going. And it's shit. Now, I do say shit that is controversial, that I do believe in, but I feel like that's different. It's like, well, that's not about being an asshole. It's not about being controversial. I mean, that's just about being like calling a spade, being like, yeah, dude, I do feel that way about this. And I feel so deeply this way about this that I have something sort of funny to say about it. Like, but as opposed to just being like, I need to just be aggressive or controversial or contrarian all the time. And I definitely found that as I deleted my social media accounts, like I became less contrarian. But the idea is that that's the only commodity on a lot of social media. So people, it tends for people to become assholes. There's a B in bummer that's for butting into everyone's lives. Social media tracks you everywhere. So it knows all your habits. It knows where you go. It knows what you're thinking when you're asleep or you're awake. So be good for goodness sake. It's basically, social media is Santa Claus, but a lot bigger. And I'm not talking fat. And it does slay. Oh, yay. Oh, yay. It slays. Beyonce. And then C, it crams content down people's throat. It gives people individualized behavior modification, which is to say that, like, you have your own feed that's sort of, like, created around your personality. And, you know, it sees your viewing habits, so it can direct you. Maybe not, like, a person consciously, but they can say, oh, a person like this tends to, these are the kinds of articles we should feed them. Technically to make them happy, right? Like, to make them use social media more. So if they're using social media more, theoretically, that means they're getting more use out of social media. However, it also could potentially mean they're just getting, you know, you're feeding them content that's making them angry. Someone who's prone to anger, well, they'll just keep reading this shit and getting increasingly angry. So, yeah, I just think that that's interesting. There's directing people's behavior in the sneakiest way possible. So, again, using subtle manipulation of what you get in your feed or what you get in ads or, you know, how you go on the internet and to accelerate engagement and increase it. There's an E in there that's earning money from letting the worst assholes secretly screw with everyone else. I think a great example of that I think is really interesting is obviously like the Cambridge Analytica thing. But you have to remember that basically the entire thing is, there's fake mobs in a faker society, and he sort of gets into that as well. But basically, he talks about the idea that, you know, social media is just this giant bummer machine. It's meant to make you sad, and sort of screw with you and, you know, bum you out. And I just think that that's like a really interesting point. The thing that I think is particularly interesting he says about it is the idea that this bummer machine that's been created with all of these features, it doesn't exist for your benefit, fundamentally. If it existed for your benefit, things might be different. But this, you know, social media is run on advertising dollars. And so, basically, this thing exists for the advertisers. They're the client. You're not the user. They're the user. And you're the product. And, you know, that's an expression that's been used a lot in 2018 when the Cambridge Analytica stuff emerged. But basically, like, right, you're the product. You are the way to make money. This entire giant machine that, like I said, you know, puts content on people's throats and, you know, encourages being an asshole and fake profiles and manipulation, it doesn't exist for your benefit as the end user. It exists for the benefit of the advertisers. And so they're going to basically, the social media companies are fundamentally going to do things to make their clients happy. And so they're going to use this in a way to, yeah, like to make their clients happy. So that's a lot of reason they target you and put you in cohorts and encourage addictive behavior, even if it creates negativity, because fundamentally it works for the bottom lines of their clients. So I just think that is a really interesting point, that this entire machine is for the purposes of the client. I think one of the more interesting points he makes in the book is that Facebook published a paper. Facebook scientists published a paper saying that they could create a feed that either makes you happier or sadder. And the idea is, like, why would they publish that if users would see it and they would be really sad about it? And he makes the point of saying, no, the point of users, the point of Facebook publishing this is because advertisers will read it and go, holy shit, like, Facebook has the power to make people happy and sad? Yeah, we probably have to pay for that product. We probably have to, like, do that. I mean, the idea is, like, of course they're going to publish a paper like that because it actually makes their product more valuable. Again, not to us as users, but to the end user, the advertiser, which is like a really deep point. I think that, you know, he also makes a comment about how journalists have to make posts designed to go viral and get traction on Facebook, which distorts the priorities of journalism. Again, maybe in some good ways, but perhaps in a lot of bad ways. I think what's interesting about that in particular is I dated, at one point I was interested in one woman who this intersects with my personal life in a very funny way, because at one point I was interested in one woman who worked for a newspaper, or worked for a magazine, a very well-respected magazine for a long time, went to China and actually worked for it. And then she actually came back, and now she left journalism, and now she's in the data marketing. She works for a company that consults with journalists about how to, you know, put their articles into the 21st century and onto the internet, and consults, you know, she's basically a consultant that helps journalists with, you know, marketing their stuff. And then what's really funny is that a girl who actually was, you know, I did fool around with, she actually worked at a company that did this kind of like data analytics work for media companies, and try to figure out, you know, how to make their articles go more viral and things like that. And now she works for NPR, for an NPR affiliate. So I just think it's funny that there's this weird revolving door between, like, people who are journalists and people who are doing, like, marketing for journalists, and figuring out how do you maximize engagement and, you know, essentially doing media consultants. So, you know, the idea that journalists are the line between journalist and media consultant is just blurred in ways that it needs to be to survive in our modern times. And, you know, how that may not always be a pretty process or lead to outcomes we like. So the next rule, I just think, you know, which goes to the bummer machine, that you know, even journalism is really, you know, has to follow the directives of, you know, of trying to make things more engaging online as opposed to focusing on journalism, because they need, Facebook has fundamentally, like, you know, switched up the social media game, y'all. And you know, I don't know, it's interesting. But yeah, so basically I am looking for a girlfriend, and yeah, maybe a third person I'll date just has some kind of connection to all of the social media stuff. The third point is that social media is making you into an asshole. It's either making you fake nice or a troll, which neither of which are sensible. Social media is about trying to score points, get under each other's skin. You choose a partner based on who you become around that person, which is an interesting point. And that when people comment on things, they don't comment on it to make a point. They comment on it to bring attention to themselves. And again, you know, he makes that analogy between cats and dogs, that lone wolves versus pack wolves. Again, this is, again, interesting to me on a personal level, that, you know, he says the lone wolves versus pack wolves, like, so close, you know, packs of wolves, it leads to mob rule, manipulation, passive aggression, reactivity, hurting, and quick fix thinking. And we stop perceiving people as individuals. We just perceive them as representatives of things, or you're a member of this tribe, and so I have to hate you, and things like that. And everyone is in a pack, and everyone is stuck in groupthink. And, you know, even your enemies are stuck in groupthink, and you're stuck in groupthink. And whereas when you're a lone wolf, you have to use your wits and your personal understanding. And whereas as part of a pack, you rely on, you know, wisdom from other people, and you just pay attention to group perceptions, as opposed to being like, what makes sense to me from based on my personal observation. And things tend to turn, you know, in a pack, things, you know, in a lone wolf, it tends to be more like creativity and exploration and things like that. Also starvation, let's be honest. But then in a pack, you know, things feel very safe, but it turns into a competition for status amongst one another. You know, this is sort of like that argument that they oftentimes say in academia, that the fights are so intense because the stakes are so low. And I think that's also true on social media, right? Like, going back to that LinkedIn thing I was talking about, and that he talks about in the book, the idea is, like, everyone gets in these big fights because, you know, I would say it's funny, because I think to some extent, some of the most career-oriented people, they tend to stay off of Facebook, and they tend to be on LinkedIn more, because they're just more like, oh, I can actually get what I want out of this, and I can meet my objective. So, I don't know, I think that there's, you know, like, the idea of, like, and I definitely have seen the way that social media is making people more into an asshole. They're not even really concerned about, like making good points. Like, some of the people I am around that, you know, I'm around them less, to be honest, right now. But like, yeah, no, there's some people where I noticed that the people who were the angriest or the most reactive, or not really listen to me in discussions, were the people who, when we were hanging out in groups, they would be on their phone just, like, scrolling through stuff and realizing, oh, there's a relationship between the amount of time you spend on your phone and how crass you are. You know, and it wasn't, I mean, it'd be one thing, like, I like a good debate. I'm fine with disagreement. But, you know, sometimes people would just, you know, it's sort of like when people, there's sometimes you interact with people and they just are sarcastic. And it's not even, like, sarcastic, like, funny sarcasm or sarcasm that, like, drives their point home. It's literally just, like, just being sort of reactive and sort of nasty. And I just think, like, that's so fucking, you know, like, that feels like it's such a product of the social media shit. I don't know. It feels like it's, you know, people being a little, just, you know, like, I've noticed around certain friends, they're just quicker to anger. They tend to be quicker to sarcasm. They don't really listen to what you're saying. They oftentimes will drop phrases that you get the sense are very popular online. They feel both a deep sense of powerlessness, that they don't get to be part of the conversation, but they also exhibit like a high level of trying to dominate you or trying to dominate your thinking. They're very set. They're both very powerless, but they're also extremely confident in their beliefs. And they express both. And so it's just this weird profile. And you notice it. I mean, I notice it a lot around comedy, but even not around comedy, just around people who are very political. Oftentimes you see these patterns, and they're a real turnoff for me. Like, there are people I had to stop hanging out with because I just didn't want to deal with it. And also the conversations with them were shit. They weren't good. They weren't good conversations. It wasn't like a lot of thought, you know, like, I mean, I don't know, like, recently I spent a lot of time with some friends who they're not on social media as much, but they're intelligent, well-read. And we were just having, like, interesting debates about things, interesting perspectives, because we were sort of, like, looking at this from, like, a first principle, whereas with some people it seems like they're just rattling off talking points. And if you're not talking about something where they have talking points on it, they just disengage. And so it's weird, because, like, you know, I don't know, like, a lot of things in my life, when I really look at my life, they don't have talking points, like, things about friendship, or getting older, or, you know, my take on politics, or, you know, what's the best way to serve myself in times that are contentious. You know, really genuine conversations about, well, what are your career aspirations, and what are your goals, and, you know, what's your relationship like with your family? How's your family doing? Like, none of that really fits into social media. That these are conversations and emotions that can't be commodified. And so I find that the people who are, the more they're on social media, the less equipped they are to really talk about things that I associate with intimacy and love and understanding and connection and real creativity. Like, you know, people who engage in a lot of social media and are assholes, I mean, not only are they assholes, even if they're not assholes, they just have a very limited tool set to engage and talk and connect with you, I find. And people who are not on social media as much, they have a deeper well because they can just talk about their lives. They're not always running around in sarcasm or dropping some kind of lingo or derailing conversations with some political topic. They're more present. I don't know. I mean, that's what I found. So those are all things that, you know, I mean, he doesn't necessarily talk about, but they're things I definitely can feel. But to continue with this, so argument number 4, social media is undermining truth. So there's fake news. He calls it fake news with fake likes and fake retweets. And so the idea is, like, there's a proliferation of fake profiles to make groups look bigger than they are. And then, in turn, social media can use the idea of these fake large groups, these puffed up groups, to make people angry. And, you know, so basically, like, for example, right, like, you can create fake accounts to make Trump's support look bigger. And, right, we know that actually a lot of the social media accounts that retweet him on Twitter are actually fake accounts from Russian agents. And then, but what that does is, yeah, so makes Trump look bigger. And then in response, that actually increases engagement from his opposition, right? Because they're like, oh, Trump's getting retweeted this much, so we're going to retweet a lot. It makes all these arguments look bigger than they are. You know, people talk about this idea of, we've even politicized or made things divisive, like vaccinations. Got anti-vaxxer groups and things like incels, the involuntarily celibate people. And, you know, even a friend of mine, my friend Chuck, who's in his 60s, was joking about incels. Like, he knows about incels. I'm not on the internet. I didn't fucking know what an incel was until like a guy mentioned it at a birthday party I was at. And, you know, of course this guy was just super jacked up, Super animated, extremely agitated, just downing shitloads of tequila, just getting totally fucked up. And, you know, and he just got them goddamn incels. And, you know, like, you know, incels are like, you know, I guess it's like this subculture online of guys who are like, I'm involuntarily celibate because, you know, our culture doesn't support manhood. And it's very anti-male. And I'm like, I don't fucking know these people because I'm out here living my goddamn life. But this group looks big. It looks like it's like, it looks, you know, it might, I mean, honestly, how many incels there might be in the country? I don't know, maybe, or in the continent, because I guess a lot of them are Canadian. Holler at Canada. Holler at Justin Trudeau. A lot of girls want to holler at Justin Trudeau. And some incels may want to holler at Justin Trudeau. He's got a strong chin. And, but he's got a strong chin, as if that explains anything. But the idea is, like, incels, right, they're probably, like, I don't know, maybe, what, maybe, like, 10,000 of them? Not that many. At maximum, there's probably, like, 10,000 of them. These involuntarily celibate, like, angry dudes. Just like, they're, like, you know, when you look at, like, Richard Spencer's people, they're probably, like, I don't know, they're probably, like, maybe 20,000 of them. In, you know, if you combine the population of Canada and the United States, Canada's probably got about 20,000 people, and America's got about 350 million people. So, you know, 350 million and 20,000 people, you only got about 20,000 people who are, you know, like, who are white supremacists. And, I mean, that's a lot of people on one hand. But they're not in power or anything, you know, and, but it they look like such a big group. And then that means that incites all the people on the left to react, or, you know, feminists versus incels. You get these natural, like, battles and competitions between groups. And, you know, those groups, incels, they look bigger than they are. The white supremacists, Richard Spencer's people, they look bigger than they are because of political coverage and online social media presence and fake accounts. And you know, great catchphrases, and so, you know, and their own websites that look like news sources, and then source, you know, liberal sources that will cite or pull articles from those sources. So it looks like they're a really big group, you know, when in fact, like, how many people are just, like, in, like, how many people in America are probably just, like, indifferent to all of this? Like, a vast majority. You know, like there aren't that many white supremacists. There aren't that many people about, you know, anti-fascist people out there. But it looks like they're fucking huge because of the way that social media coverage and journalist coverage distorts things. It fucking distorts the shit out of things. And, you know, and it whips us up. And what does it do? It furthers engagement. I don't know. I mean, like, that, those patterns are troubling to me. And, you know, the fact that I don't know anything about incels, the fact that I don't really know anything about Richard Spencer except the airtime that he's being given by, like, by, you know, people are reacting, you know. It's funny how people hate incels, but they're mentioning them all the time in conversation. It's like, you guys are the best marketing for them, you know. Everyone else is sort of indifferent. They're content to live their lives. So anyways, yeah, I don't know. I just think that's interesting.
So, yeah, so moving on to argument number 5, social media is making what you say meaningless. And I think this is, like, interesting because it's this idea, basically what he is saying is we're all, because of social media and, like, our individual feeds, we're all living in different realities, basically, at this point. Like, we're just... We're, like, living on our own thing, and we all have our own feeds, you know? Like, so when we pull up websites, and I've played with this, actually. I've gone to, like, Huffington Post, and I've opened up the same thing based on, you know, my browser with all my cookie history and all that good-ish, and then I've opened up one with an incognito browser, opened it up on my phone, and I noticed that even though the stories are the same, the headlines are different, and the headlines seem to be, like, geared towards different things. So, like, when there was news about a black mayor winning, you know, very prominently said, oh, hey, this guy's a black mayor in my feed because they probably know I'm black because of all the Jericho products I purchase. And, you know, Although they might think I'm white because of all the ergonomic healthy back shoes I look at. All the hiking shoes and zero drop soles I look at. Also, perhaps all the golf clubs I look at. They probably are like, this guy's maybe he's a Tiger Woods type of guy. And but basically, like, the Huffington Post knows, like, it knows that I'm black, and so it'll give me something like slightly different to just like entice me a little bit more, right? Or like, or alternately enrage me a little bit more, because that's the way like social media can work. I feel like I should trick it. I feel like I should start checking out like F-150 websites and like country music, like trying to buy Toby Keith tickets to like throw all this stuff off, you know, like start fucking ordering mayo on Amazon. I don't know, country music, American flag paraphernalia, like shorts and t-shirts. Maybe if I get a American flag bandana, I mean, you know I'm white as fuck, and you know it, I know it, we all know it. So maybe I should just start trying to fuck with all of these trackers. But anyways, the point is, I notice that there's a difference, and I think, like, you know, that we all have our own, well, I mean, actually, I realize I'm mixing it up. So that actually gets into something we'll talk about later. But basically, what it is saying is, like, it makes everything meaningless. So there's no context for everything, right? So, like, I noticed this started happening in comedy, where, like, I would make some kind of joke, and people would take it the wrong way, or, like, try to find some issue with it. They'd be like, oh, so basically you're saying this about this group. And I'm like, no, I'm just making this observation. But people are extrapolating what I'm saying, extrapolating, ladies and gentlemen, to what I'm saying to, like, come to some other conclusion. I originally thought it was people misunderstanding me, which reminds me of, like, law, because there's this weird sense in which, like, you can, like, intentionally misunderstand, you can strategically, like, misunderstand what someone says so you can define it for yourself. I don't know. It's a very fun technique. It is excellent if you want to fuck up Thanksgiving. I'll just say that, you know, just like intentionally misunderstanding people. Like, you said this, but like, I heard this, so I'm going to insist, like, you said X, but I heard Y, so I'm going to insist that you said Y. And I've always, like, this has annoyed the shit out of me, and it's made it very hard to talk with certain people or like communicate, because it feels like people are essentially taking what you're saying and they're chopping it up into sound bites. And what this book taught me, I was really angry about that. And really disappointed, and but you know, thankfully, what this book has taught me is it's all true, and that's exactly what's happening. We're always taking each other's words out of context, because, you know, like, social media is like literally like a phrase. Like, you'll put up a blip, and everything is sort of a soundbite. A hot take is essentially a soundbite on anything, and so it's so easy to take that out of context, because you could have a very long conversation. And you can, you know, and then it just becomes like on, you know, and the other person can just interpret it and pull the pieces they want. Now, what I've learned is I can't really complain, because I feel like maybe it is also whining in the context of stand-up. Because, you know, what it has made me realize is if I'm saying words and they're floating out there without context and people are attaching their own context to it, I realize that it's part of my responsibility to also bring context to what I'm saying so people know how I arrived at my feelings about things. And I think the book was really helpful for doing that. Instead of being like fucking angry and being like, these motherfuckers don't understand me, I was more like, oh, they are attaching their own context to what I'm saying, so I need to bring context in my joke, in what I say, to make sure they follow me and make sure they see my point of view. Even if they don't agree with it, at least they understand that it is a point of view. It's not just something to like put a fucking thumb in someone's goddamn eye, at least 9 out of 10 times. The 10th time, oh, the thumb is going in there. It's really trying to dig in. I'm breaking all of the UFC rules. But yeah, I mean, you know, like, so I have to bring my own context. So, you know, which is, I mean, disappointing, but also, like, ultimately makes me happy to realize that, because, you know, the alternative is just assuming that everyone is maliciously misinterpreting me. Which, you know, it does make me happy. You know, I turn into a mean old dwarf, and I don't mean in the in our world sense. I mean in like the J.R.R. Tolkien sense, like being a grumpy, you know, wizened motherfucker with a long beard who just is, you know, like, is sort of friendly, but also sort of like, fucking humans. Like, that's, you know, leave my pot of gold away. But yeah, I found myself getting grumpy, and the idea that, like, social media makes my what I say contextless, and it's my responsibility to bring context, was like a snap. It was like, oh, I get it. It's on me, and this doesn't naturally occur, so I have to add it in. You know, it's like, you gotta add Yellow 5 so everyone knows they're drinking Mountain Dew. Basically, what he says, he has this quote that I think is interesting about this idea of contextless content. And he says, quote unquote, when context is applied after the fact, communication and culture become petty, shallow, and predictable. You have to say something pretty extreme to survive even briefly in an unpredictable context. And I totally can feel that. And realizing that, you know, the solution isn't to say something extreme, actually, or to try to stake out a place and rile people up. The solution is to bring context to what I'm saying, and then you'll understand how I arrived at what I am saying. So actually, I feel like this in particular, like, was an interesting idea to me, because it feel like maybe has the capacity to make me a better communicator. And so I'm grateful, you know, instead of being bitter. How about that for a 180? See? This book isn't all bad. It's positive at times. He also highlights podcasts, as an example of something that insists on context, right? Like, you're listening to this, I don't know, when everything is said and done, this episode is probably going to be like an hour and like 15 minutes, maybe an hour and 20 minutes. It's going to be long as shit. And the idea is that's all context. You know exactly how I got into this book. I told you at the top how I found out about it. What it means to me, why it meant something to me, how it affects the way I interact with people or the way I do stand-up. Like, that's all context. Like, you can't take a snippet of this. Well, you probably could. I guess, you know, if you're creative with, you know, like, sound editing equipment or software. But basically, there's a context for everything I'm saying, you know. So, presumably, maybe you've listened to other episodes of this, so you know what kind of person I am, which is to say, a bastard. And yeah, but you're like, okay, well, he's a bastard saying bastard things. Well, even that's okay. See? Context is amazing. It's the best. The context is like the golden hour. Golden hour is to photos as context is to connection. Context is like the golden hour of connection. It is it's also the golden shower of connection. I'm not going to explain that to you. Go ask your mothers what that means. and if they tell you, boy, yeah, your mom's an interesting person. oh, yes, I have to weave in. Somehow I have to weave in a reference to Peace Sports into a really deep conversation about social media and modern society. But hey, I didn't tell you that this was kosher. Okay, argument number 6, social media is destroying your capacity for empathy. Social media is destroying your capacity for empathy. I just wanted to restate that for the people who are not living in the 1940s, listening at home, who may have not gotten that weird baseball announcer voice. Social media is destroying your capacity for empathy. And then there's an image of a spinning paper a spinning paper, and you get bewildered by it, and then it stops suddenly, and it just says that across the headline, and it's like some defunct New York newspaper at the top. All the news that's fit to print. Ladies and gentlemen, argument number 6 is a really interesting one. I think actually this is one of the more interesting ones, and it's totally connected to the last one, which is all about the idea that social media subtracts context from reality. And basically, it talks about this idea that the way that we have empathy with one another is that we have a theory of the mind of one another, which is something, I mean, it's a concept I've always loved, but again, he articulates it very well for a white guy with dreadlocks. I mean, he's just killing it, you know? He's like the Colin Powell of white guy with dreadlocks, you know? No drums, all pros. And But basically, you know, the idea is like for you to empathize with another person, you have to be able to construct a theory of mind for them, which is to say you have to be able to understand how, like, you have to understand how other people see the world, essentially, right? That's what it means to have a theory of mind. Like, I understand how you could perceive the world a certain way. And the idea is, even if I don't agree with how you perceive the world, at least I understand that you have a point of view, and I can interact and conceive of that point of view. And the idea is that this is necessary for empathy, because I have to be able to see how you see the world to be able to connect with you on, like, a human-to-human level if we don't see the world the same way. And the idea is that social media is bulldozing that shit. It is, it's just putting it down. It's shooting it in the head and throwing it in a ditch that's 10 feet deep, and then dumping a bunch of dirt on it, and then leaving a rose at the top, and then putting AstroTurf on top. And then a honey badger just hangs out and guards the spot. I don't know. Someone explained to me about honey badgers earlier today. And that's like a whole internet thing as well. That's like women who are into incels. I think all of this, it just starts to sound like fan fiction. It doesn't even seem like real. Like, people are getting angry about shit. That's like me getting angry about, like, God damn it. Can you believe how the fucking men of Rohan turn their backs on Gondor? Like, it's all fantasy. It's all made up, because it's just all these fake personas and fake personalities on social media. Anyways, back to the issue at hand, which is my frustration with all this shit and how this book sorts through all of that. But yeah, basically, the theory of the mind is very important, so you can understand things. And the idea is that if we're all given individualized feeds, and we're also all given information that sort of caters to our interest and our pre-existing belief system, right? Either the internet gives us that information, and then we gravitate towards it, and it leads us in a breadcrumb back to its, you know, ideological fuck den, if you will. Or alternately, if, you know, basically, like, an algorithm actually just straight up just gives us information based on its understanding of who we are. So if I am a white conservative 20-something male, then, you know, and I'm presumably friends, it's going to know, because I'm friends with other white 20-something conservative males, then Facebook's algorithm is going to give me articles and promote things that my friends are reading. I mean, not to mention the fact that my friends may just post that shit, and then that's just what's going to be in my feed. But, you know, he basically describes it this way. Imagine if you went to Wikipedia, and I love this analogy. It's like if you went to Wikipedia and it just showed you, like, you know, you looked up something, and say you looked up something and it would show you different versions of the entry based on your ethnicity, your profession, your geography, and your income level. We might praise this on some level, because actually it might make Wikipedia more accessible. For example, if you have a low reading level, then maybe it gives you a Wikipedia version in very basic English. That's nothing above a third grade reading level. Maybe in that way it's very accessible. But, which is actually, that's actually an interesting idea. I should start a business around this. It's called USA Today. And, say you looked up an entry, like, it looked up based on ethnicity, right? So you might get an entry, like, you look up George Washington, or you look up Thomas Jefferson, right? And if you're black, the first thing that comes up for George Washington or Thomas Jefferson is the idea that they were, you know, raping slaves, you know? And, or if you're white, it might play up, oh, these guys are great statesmen. And literally, you're seeing different things. So, like, a black viewer is seeing this, you know, a certain conception of Thomas Jefferson. Certain things are on the page or closer to the top, and some things are left off entirely. And if you're white, maybe the slavery and, you know, Sally Hemings and sleeping with slaves and all that stuff is totally, like, left off of it. And so then we try to talk about Thomas Jefferson, and we literally cannot connect, because we're just getting totally different versions of the same Wikipedia page. It is eventually, like, obviously that's a pretty drastic idea, but in a sense, through the power and magic and beauty of Facebook, and when I say beauty, I do mean Mark Zuckerberg's eyes, and his t-shirts, they fit so well. Through the beauty of that, like, we do have different experiences fundamentally, And like, so it's going to be hard for us to even talk about Thomas Jefferson without like being like I'm just bringing up the shit. And I'm bringing up like Sally Hemings. And then this other guy's like, what are you talking about? That's not on Thomas Jefferson's page. Like, our conception of America is the shatter. Our conception of all these ideas that we talk about and these principles that we talk about are so far apart from one another because we're looking at totally different parts of the same thing. You know, it's like to me, you know, you ever hear that story of like an elephant and the idea that like, you know, if you got a bunch of blind men together and they touched an elephant, one person would be like, oh, it's like the one guy's touching the horn. He's like, oh, this animal's like all like really like hard and tough and cool to the touch. And then someone else is like touching the trunk and they're like, oh, it's all like slimy and warm. And then someone else is like touching a leg and they're like, oh, it's all like loose skin and like wrinkles and shit. And then, you know, like someone else is grabbing the tail of the elephant and they're like, oh, it's really like smooth and like sort of like gets skinny. It's like a snake. And the idea is that like we all, if we don't realize that we're all seeing an elephant and we're just feeling around with our hands, we're having entirely different experiences of an elephant. I always feel bad in that hypothetical because I'm like, my God, all these blind men are touching an elephant. Like, that elephant is going to get panicked and it's going to fuck all of them. It's going to kill all those dead fictional blind guys. So that analogy always makes me nervous in a weird sort of way. Or not analogy, you know, that expression? Yeah, analogy. Let's say analogy. Whatever. It's a podcast. No one's checking. Podcast. But yeah, no one else is. I don't have a conception of what you're seeing. You don't have a conception of what I'm seeing because we're all getting individualized feeds. And so we just butt heads and we just get really angry. And he talks about how, like, social media is sort of designed to do this because if they can get us into cohorts, if they can get us into subgroups, then they can be able to target their advertising very, very effectively, right? So if you know it's all like, you know, 20-something hipster kombucha drinking motherfuckers, then you'll know that they all like fucking want like ads for, I don't know, like, I don't know, some new tech device, or like they all want ads for like a certain, you know, like one of these like, you know, chests of clothing they send to you every month, or, you know, some bullshit like that. Basically, just the idea is that social media by design is trying to group us into these cohorts, into these little subgroups based on demographics and our browsing history, so they can then group us into a group and then sell us, market a certain kind of advertising, or they can make some generalizations about us as a subgroup. And the idea is the more they treat us like a subgroup, the more we actually think of ourselves as a subgroup, even if no one is explicitly saying anything about this subgroup. The idea is, like, if we're all getting the same messaging, if we're all getting, like, ad one and everyone else is getting ad two, we're just going to start to see the world differently. And we're also going to coalesce around each other. We're going to find each other and we're going to reinforce our views of the world. And the idea is this works for the social media company because it's cheaper. It's cheaper when you can group people and target with them at. And also it's more effective because you have this little subgroup. And we'll go along with it because, I don't know, because we're fucking righteous and we feel like people should, you know, share our worldview. And, you know, basically a side effect of all of this, which is just generally a giant advertising scheme and you know, demographic targeting scheme, which, again, is in the service of advertising and the bummer empire, as Mr. Dreadlocks, Mr. White Bob Marley calls it, Jérôme Lanier. For those of you keeping score at home, he does have dreadlocks, and I fucking love that. That tribalism is a side effect of this entire grouping people into cohorts. And so we actually will self-optimize and self-sort to become more tribal. Eventually, once we start defining ourselves a certain way, we actually purify ourselves, and we actually kick out a lot of people and reinforce, like, you must subscribe to these belief systems to fuck with us. And that's what you see, right? I mean, when people make these comments, I remember I talked with one dude and he was just like, yeah, like, I agree with my girlfriend on like 99% of things, but like the 1% that I don't agree with her on, like, it's like I'm a fucking Hitler youth, you know? And I tell him, you know, man, well, you just gotta stop wearing those goddamn boots and maybe she'll go easy on you. But for real, what I tell him is, yeah, you know, like, because if people start pushing us into cohorts, and by people, I mean, you know, social media, groupings, if they start pushing us into cohorts and then we buy into those cohorts, then we're going to try pushing out other people who don't believe what we exactly what we believe. And the idea is then the you know, sort of our theory of the mind basically goes into the shitter, and it's impossible to really understand each other. It's like we're all speaking different languages. It's amazing, because this is almost, to me, like, this is almost analogous to the Tower of Babel, which is this biblical story that, you know, man, we're all speaking, you know, at some point in time, obviously, the story, not true, but I'm like, you know, but it's an interesting analogy, which is the idea that, like, there was a point in time where all mankind spoke the same language, and so they collaborated and then tried to build a tower up to the heavens to go up to heaven. And God didn't want a tower built up to heaven because that would fuck with his real estate prices with all these goddamn humans moving into the neighborhood. And he was like, not in my backyard. So what he did was he struck humanity with like this malaise where suddenly everyone started speaking different languages. Because his belief was, look, if everyone speaks different languages, they won't be able to get along and they'll never be able to collaborate. And if they can't collaborate, they can't build this like tower up to the heavens. And if they can't build this tower up to the heavens, I can still charge $3,000 for a one bedroom up in heaven. And he was like, that's a dope real estate deal. So he decided to just strip humanity where we couldn't communicate with one another. And suddenly we lost power relative to God, which it's interesting that story is sort of in the Bible, because like, I was like, oh man, that really sucks to be us. And God's like, deal with it. Also, you have to put down a deposit. You have to put down a full a month's rent and your first month's rent. You have to pull down a month of rent down as a deposit and first month's rent. You have to, if you want to have a pet, you got to pay another $500 as a pet deposit because you may have to clean up afterwards. Also, you have to pay for your own internet, water, electricity. Also, there's no stove in this apartment. And you're going to have to buy your own stove and your own fridge and move it in. Because, you know, that God wants to, you know, he's not a slumlord. These are really, really nice condos. But, I mean, but the HOA, the condo fees are fucking crazy in heaven. And, you know, he can't have that going down. So he strikes everyone. Everyone speaks different languages and they're all angry at each other. They're calling each other fascists and racists. And feminists, which really shouldn't be a bad word, and misogynists, and red pill motherfuckers, and incel motherfuckers, and baby killers, and women haters, and just like all this shit. So that's what it feels like. We don't really have like we don't really understand one another's motivations. We're like aliens to one another, and we can't collaborate on shit. We can't build these towers. We can't drop these rents. Goddamn. Okay, rant over. So yeah, we just seem crazy to one another, basically, is what he says, because we don't have a theory of each other's minds. I don't know what you're seeing. And his point is that over time, even as we see ourselves more clearly, as in a reflection, through a glass darkly, I'm trying to quote, you know, the Bible and seem, you know, Mad Deep, as they say. That was Mobb Deep's first name, actually, Mad Deep, when they were a poetry duo at Oberlin College, before they became a gangster rap duo who robbed and people like 50 Cent. They were a poetry duo, Mad Deep, with two D's, just to be, you know, in honor of the Beat Poets. But basically, like, just, you know, like, we see, to be Mad Deep, we see less and less of what the other people are seeing, and so we can't understand them, and so everyone just seems crazy to us who don't exist in our precise bubble, and it just makes us unhappy, and I feel that. I really do feel that, and again, having an awareness of this at least makes me able to see, okay, maybe I can fight against this in my own life. I can try to just like connect with you by asking how your kids are, and if you say you don't have any kids, well, I'll say, check again. You might. What about now? You know, as a way to relate. But I think there are ways to get around this. I think one of them is reading sources that other people read that you don't read. Like, I think I had this mind-blowing experience when I was in Colorado where I watched CNBC all week. And it was just so fascinating because it's like a totally different way of looking at the world. It's this business, money-driven way of looking at the world, which I really loved. I loved being able to be exposed to it and to realize, oh, people have a totally different way of thinking about the world, and it's I want to spend time there. Whereas, I mean, you know, I'll say even pre-social media, when I was in college, I totally was the person that would shit on CNBC. And I would shit on capitalism and things like that. And now that I'm a crusty old man who wants a nice 401k and a gold watch when he retires, of course, I no, that's not the reasons why I care about CNBC. It's because those people are part of the world, too, and I want to understand how they think about things. Right, I'm not friends with probably a lot of people who are on the who watch CNBC. I'm not friends with them on social media, so I'm not going to get that view of the world. Or if I did, it would just make me angry because I would think I would, you know, come to Facebook with this sense of entitlement and be like, well, I'm going to go on Facebook. Of course, I should just see things that reinforce what I believe. What else is Facebook for? That and, you know, trying to holler at people you used to fool around with. Of course, I think that's why he really created it. Just ask all the, you know, 50-year-olds giving each other herpes now. It's like they're in high school again. And because they're connecting online and, you know, dropping in them DMs. Kids are out of the house now and I'm divorced. Hey, you want to come over? For sure. Should I bring wine coolers? Nah. I got my whiskey cabinet for my husband in the divorce. Come on over, baby. So anyways, argument number seven is a good one. It's, that social media is making you unhappy, basically, which is, you know, the idea is like, it just doesn't make you feel good. And that's a reason to delete your social media account. And this one basically just goes that, you know, it sort of goes back to some of the things that I mentioned earlier that, you know, a lot of social media is designed or, you know, it preys on our feelings of insecurity and our need and desire to feel secure, high status, accepted, part of the pack, and not exposed and alone, not out on our own, on our lonesome. And basically, right, social media is making you unhappy because it's just making you play this comparison game, and it's also incentivizing you to engage in attention-seeking behavior, which I talked about earlier and which he talks about earlier in the book, is the quickest way to get attention online is to just be an asshole and to pick a fight with someone or to say something outrageous that just makes a lot of people angry, as opposed to bringing your real experience to things. So we, you know, social media is incentivizes engaging in attention-seeking behavior. One of the things I think is really interesting is he talks about this idea that, like, social media has created this space where we were so excited to be in it because it was like it was a space that everyone could see us. But the trade-off that we didn't consider is that there's constant judgment in this space. And so we haven't been able to create, like, a space. Like, essentially, right now, if you are really engaged in social media, you know, there's an inability to carve out a space in which to invent oneself without constant judgment and scrutiny. And that was how I felt about social media. I was like, oh, you know, my first thought wasn't, is this shit funny? Is this something I can relate to? Is this something that means something to me? It was like, are people going to like this? Are people going to get this? Are they going to understand it? And, you know, are they going to give me likes? Or am I going to post something that's going to get 2 likes and I'm going to feel like a fucking loser? That's probably not what I need to be thinking about when I think about trying to connect with people. That's like a weird way to start thinking about trying to connect with people, you know? That's like going to a party and thinking you have like this big zit on your face, you know? Or like, I don't know, going to, like, I don't know, like, an audition for something. Like, an audition for a musical, a high school musical, let's say. And just, like, pissing your pants and just, like, then just trying to cover up that wet spot. I can't think of, yeah, that probably would be about the worst thing to do. And I'd be worried that, like, if I accepted, now, going into that scenario, I'd be worried that if I just was, like, comfortable with myself and accepted the fact that I'd pee on my pants, I would just, like, start singing and I would just involuntarily start peeing on myself some more. Like, I just, you know, I just totally see that as a really strong possibility for some reason. I see it as strong a possibility as both the possibility is strong and the stream real strong. Because his prostate real healthy, y'all. Ladies. But yeah, you know, and I will say that, like, you know, for example, this podcast is the opposite for me. It's sort of like this place, it's like I ramble and it's fun And presumably there's judgment, but like, I don't really have to, you know, I'm not dealing with it. It's not, you know, it's like, don't listen if you don't want to listen. I've already said that multiple times. And so it's more like, this is a space to invent myself and to explore what's important to me and not to be preoccupied with like how other people are going to react or this instant feedback machine. It's more like, I dumped this weird shit in this machine and hopefully some fun shit happens. I'm going to say shit a bunch because I just got some polling data that says that if I say shit, millennials will be into my stuff more. Anyways, so enough about people pleasing. But yeah, like, you know, so, you know, he analogizes, it's like we're all in this big pit and we're doing all the digging as users of social media. And the ones who are making all the money are like these big companies and just how that's weird. He talks about, drinking some water and, you know, like, it was good, tasty water. But like, you know, he basically has this quote where he says, how can you find happiness without authentic self-esteem? How can you be authentic when everything you read, say, or do is being fed into a judgment machine? And to that, I say, I second it. Yeah, I mean, it's hard to find that necessarily online. And, you know, I don't know. I'm just going to read this passage because I think it's fun and because I think he captures a lot of interesting things. He says, to be clear, two levels of judgment going on in the bummer machine. One kind can be understood by humans and might be seen by humans. The internet is filled with opinions about you personally, right now. How many friends and followers do you have? Are you hot? Are you attractive? How many points in whatever system this is have you earned? Do you have enough friends? Did you get a virtual gold star or maybe some virtual confetti from a store because you convinced others to use the same store? So that's the external judgment that's used. And then the other part of judgment is basically the data analysis part of looking at you. He says the other level of judgment is based on mathematical correlations that people might not ever see or be able to interpret. These are sometimes called intermediate layer interpretations because of how they are generated within machine learning algorithms. They are used to optimize bummer sneakiness. What ads are most likely to have a certain effect on you? What news? What cute cat pictures mixed in to the feed of news you are getting from family members? So the idea is like you're being, you know, everything is being crunched. You're being crunched up by your peers that you're on social media with, that you're sort of friends with / competing with. But you're also being judged in sort of this way that, like, the system is dicing you and coming up with a profile of you. And you're just so focused on being seen, you're so preoccupied and self-aware about being seen that you're not really exploring and deepening who you are. And I will say that, yeah, I mean, I find that I feel like people who are on social media, it's just like there's not really a lot of depth, you know what I mean? It's like an inch of soil, and then you just hit metal. And I mean, they're lovely people, you know what I mean? Like sometimes I even, you know, I had dinner with someone tonight who sort of exhibits, some of these qualities, but you know, at a certain point you're just like, we're not really going deeper. We're not really going to issues. We're just, you know, dealing in polemics, which is goofy while this other company makes just a shitload of money. And I actually, in a future episode, I'll talk about like this interesting thing where I realized like actually watching CNBC all week sort of made me profoundly realize that like, left and right politics miss a lot of shit that's actually going on in our society. It doesn't really explain how power flows. And so as much as, you know, the more I buy into like the left and right in the media and shit like that, I'm actually missing really the big picture of how stuff really works. And which is based on the flow of money. And I say that not in any kind of cynical way. I say that like, yeah, no. I mean like economics dictates our, you know, our realities and incentives and opportunities and structure of our society, and like left and right and anti-abortion and pro-choice and all this stuff, like it misses, you know, like Black Lives Matter, All Lives Matter, like it misses so much of what is really fucking going on. Similarly, in the same way that like we're arguing on Facebook, but what's really going on is like advertisers are making a bunch of money. And, you know, hey, that's fine. I'm not necessarily against them making a bunch of money, but I think it's a little weird that we come out of it with a different conception of what's going on, what this is about. Anyways, enough editorializing about an editorial book. So anyways, moving on to argument number 8. It's basically that social media doesn't want you to have economic dignity, which I think is a really interesting idea. Again, this sort of continues on what I already said earlier in argument number 7. But basically that social media is fundamentally an extractive field. Everything is run by advertising. So everything is free, but there's also pressures to monetize everything. Whereas, the old idea, right, is you pay for something and then, well, they make money from you paying for it. So, you know, they're going to be interested in serving you. But if, you know, if Facebook makes money from advertisers, then ultimately they're interested in serving advertisers. And, you know, I didn't really understand this for a long time. You know, as recently as 3 years ago, I was talking with a friend of mine who is really, really into privacy law. Shout out to Sumit. And he, like, he's really into privacy. He's a big, big Apple guy. Big, big Apple guy. Big proponent for him. And I would ask him why, and he's like, because they keep all my information private, and they're not figuring out how to monetize it. Because fundamentally, they're a hardware business. And they make money selling hardware and taking a cut of sales through their app store. And they also make money on both selling music through iTunes as well as through subscriptions to Apple Music. So this is the ways they make money. They don't make money selling my data. So they keep my data private. And I sort of joke, man, I fucking love Google. I love how accessible and free all the shit on Google is. I like the fact that Android phones are cheaper. I like the fact that apps are cheaper in the Android store. The fact that it's an open system and I can install third-party applications. Did I mention that the phones are cheaper? I love all that stuff. You know, like, I sort of joked with him at the time. I was like, man, I love these innovations at Google. I love the fact that, like, I could put something on my calendar and Google will figure out in advance how long it'll take me to drive there. And it can actually tell me when to leave. Right? Because if I put something in my calendar and it knows, hey, you have to be over in, you have to be over at the Rose Bowl by 1 p.m., then it will calculate, okay, well, how long does it get to the Rose Bowl? It'll take, you know, whatever, it'll take you 35 minutes. Okay, well, you know, let Jack know that if he's got to be there at 1 p.m., he, you know, let him know at 11:30 that he's probably got to leave by 12:15 to give himself a 10-minute buffer and arrive with 10 minutes to spare. And it's like, if I could have a Google device that could buzz me and tell me that, that would be fucking incredible. I'd love it. And he sort of saw this as problematic. He said fundamentally, you know, it might not really be a good idea that, like, all your data is out there like that. Like, yeah, I mean, it seems convenient and it makes your life easier. But keep in mind that, like, that information can be used against you for bad purposes. And, of course, you know, I was mostly thinking identity theft, things like that. And I was like, well, Google's not going to let that happen. And it's true. To this day, you know, for the most part, I don't think Google does let that happen. But obviously, the fact that my information is out there and information about me and my use of things like Gmail is, you know, are being used to for their own agendas and to make money for them, that is a concern. And I realize that that is an issue. But I like what he says in this particular argument, because he points out that, like, you know, social media doesn't, like, the idea of, you know, the idea that everything is free and it runs on advertising originally started with, like, very utopian and good intentions. It was the idea of the free software movement, which is the idea that, like, in the future, software will be free and we'll have this open society. And it was a beautiful idea, but his point was that where it turned weird was the idea of, well, if people don't pay for software, how are we going to make money off of it? You know, if the people don't pay for services like search and email and news, if they don't pay for these things, how are these things going to be sustainable as models? And the way is to sell ads against all this shit. And if we're going to sell ads against this shit, then we need to understand who our target audience is so we can target ads effectively, so we can maximize the value of each ad we sell. I don't want to sell ad, you know, if I can get granulated data on each kind of phone user, then, you know, ads that are really effective are going to be ads that are targeted to me. And then Google can charge the highest, they can charge top dollar for that because they know exactly who's the kind of person who would want to influence, you know, Jack. what does Jack like to buy? Okay, well, he likes to buy a lot of, he looks at a lot of shoes. Okay, well, if I can connect Jack specifically, but he doesn't buy trucks. So I'm not going to give Jack, I used to give everyone an F-150 ad. You know, Google used to give everyone an F-150 ad. And then they realized, well, you know what, why don't we not give F-150 ads that? Why don't we not give one to Jack? Because Jack seems to be more interested in buying high-end shoes. So we can give him a targeted ad for that. And we can charge a lot to the company that wants him to buy their high-end shoes. Because there's a good chance that if we know that Jack is into shoes, we know this company is trying to sell these high-end shoes. And we know, so there's a pretty good chance that if we show this ad to Jack, it'll push him in the direction of buying this shoe. Whereas if we put an F-150 in front of him, ad in front of him, he's never going to buy an F-150. And I will say, because of watching American football, I've seen a lot of F-150 ads, and I've never been moved to buy one. Just because I'm not really the target audience for it, based on my ethnicity, my income, geographically where I live. I live in a city, having, you know, I don't work as a contractor. I don't have to transport material, so it doesn't really make sense. But, like, an F-150 is, like, a great ad to sell, maybe in some cases, against a sporting event, because you got a lot of blue-collar guys who work with their hands and need trucks. So, but I have to see that ad, and it's almost like a waste of Ford's money for me to see the ad, because I'm never going to buy the car. And that was because broadcast TV can show only, you know, it shows one ad to, like, everybody in, you know, everyone who watches KTLA or whatever the local news affiliate is. But obviously, if they can direct an ad specifically to me, they're not going to throw an F-150 ad up. It's not worth much to Ford for me to see that shit. But for New Balance to show me this high-end shoe, that's probably worth a lot to them. If the shoe sells for like $109, which is what I bought these shoes for, I fucking love them, then, you know, it's probably worth, you know, maybe, I don't know, maybe not a dollar, but it's probably worth like, I don't know, 25 cents, 50 cents for me to see this ad. Because, you know, it could really tip things. And so they can charge top dollar, you know, top quarters for me to see that. Google can charge New Balance top quarters for me to see that ad. And that's how we undermine the economic dignity. Also, if it all runs on advertising and it's not a subscription service, then none of us, all we do, if any of us make money, it's got to be from advertising ourselves. Like, if I put something online, I'm making money from advertising. I don't, you know, my relationship fundamentally is still, I bring in money, I bring in eyeballs to YouTube, and then YouTube gives me money for bringing eyeballs to it. I don't have a direct relationship with consumers. I could set up my own store, but at least in, you know, in the context of social media, I'm pretty much just like this, like, weird, you know, I'm basically just like a disaster for people to see that brings people in. And makes, you know, and gets eyeballs there. So, you know, I don't have a direct relationship with the consumer. And that's different. You know, it's different when a newspaper runs totally on ads. Like, look at newspapers that are free versus newspapers that cost even a nominal amount of money but still run ads. The quality of journalism is higher. They take the reader much more seriously. And, you know, obviously some of that is a business strategic decision. But some of that is, I think, a perception of who the consumer is and what exactly it is that they want and need, and how can we play and cater to them to get our objectives met. So I guess what I'm just saying is, like, there's a higher quality level of journalism that you pay for. And I think part of that is because there's just a sense of people who pay for journalism are more educated, so the market will bear it, will bear, you know, a more advanced vocabulary in a newspaper. But I also think another part of it is that, you know, they don't have to play the biggest audience because they're making some money off of the fact that I'm willing to pay for it, as well as selling ads that I will see in the paper. So I guess what I'm just trying to say is, you know, free software, free, I mean, you know, this is what Jérôme Lanier fundamentally gets at, is this idea that, you know, it's great that we have free stuff, but there's actually like this dark side to it where it doesn't really always work. Anyways, to get to like the last, you know, the second, the penultimate rule is that Social media is, or not rule, arguments. Why am I talking like this is an episode of Real Time with Bill Maher? New rules. Rule number nine. No, argument number nine is social media is making politics impossible. I think this is a very interesting subject. And I think I don't, this is the one where I feel like the jury is out about whether he's right or wrong. But basically, he talks about the idea that social media and, you know, the proliferation of fake profiles, attention seeking through asshole behavior, you know, moving us into cohorts where we self-regulate and focus on our own purity, ideological purity as a community, and we don't really understand people outside of us because we can't develop a theory of mind about what they're seeing, and we lack empathy for them. Basically, all of this stuff comes together, all of the different arguments he's made. This is almost like an argument that combines a lot of these other arguments he's made earlier in the book. Basically say, when you combine all of these negative forces, all of these other reasons to delete your social media account, here's a really big reason to delete your social media account, which is that when all of these forces interact, it becomes hellish to be on social media, and everything becomes, communication becomes extremely dysfunctional, and everyone's got their wires crossed, and people are angry all the time, and people are antagonizing other people all the time, and you know, and it's just making, and you know, his case in point is that it's making politics impossible. He uses politics, I mean, he makes a lot of human endeavors very much complicates them, but it certainly makes politics much, much more difficult. Basically, he explores this idea that we have this faith in social media activism and you know, presence to that, you know, it's almost like this giant voting machine. It's like true democracy where everyone can chime in at any time. And, you know, if we get all these people together and we create these collectives where we can all be very active and involved, we're ultimately going to get a better world, right? And this is, I mean, it's interesting because this is an argument that is, I think, something we believe as Americans. We believe on, like, almost a spiritual sort of level that democracy is good. And also that we really believe in total democracy, you know. I'm sure you remember that teacher you always, that history teacher you always had that said, we don't actually live in a democracy. We live in a republic. We have representatives who advocate for our interests, or, you know, and or go to strip clubs and or harass pages in Congress and or take kickbacks. But basically, we have representatives that actually do things. We don't actually have a democracy, because in a democracy, everyone would be voting. Everyone would be chiming in dynamically. And the idea is that social media, boom, it can finally happen where we actually can all chime in. We, you know, we're reaching a point, admittedly, where we actually, you know, an old idea was that, well, you had to have a republic. You had to have representatives. Why? Because it would be impossible to get everyone to vote dynamically on things. You know, just at the moment, like, we, you know, in a true democracy, every citizen would vote on everything. We wouldn't maybe even have a legislature. And arguably, we're getting closer and closer to that through the power of technology. Not to say that everyone in America has a phone, but if we reach a point where everyone literally can get a phone, and it maybe costs you nothing, you could get to a point where, you know, you create initiatives for people, you people vote on things, and you just get, like, a notification to your phone, and you vote on issues. And everyone in America can just vote on their phones on all these issues, and we really can have democracy where we don't elect representatives. We vote on things directly. It's like constitutional amendments in California, which, you know, to some degree is really empowering, and other people say is extremely dysfunctional and a way to exploit things. And this sort of goes to Jaron Lanier's point, which is that democracy, when we really think about it, is, you know, it's a set of principles, it's a set of practices. But democracy is also just the idea of everyone votes. That's on our core, that's part of what we believe. And social media is that. It's this idea that everyone votes, and so we'll get great outcomes because everyone votes. But the idea is that's not a set of democratic values. That's just simply, you know, total democracy. And so, you know, he would say that, you know, democracy, and this is a quote from him in the book, democracy was confused with a thin faith that online collective dynamics would lead to a better world. A self-organized revolution could do no wrong. here, we thought, was the realization of our faith in networks. And what he's talking about specifically is the Arab Spring and the idea that during the Arab Spring, social media became this way for everyone to collectively express their disgust and dislike of governments in these different Arab countries. And these governments were either challenged and fell or at least were challenged very publicly, and their legitimacy was challenged. A great example is Egypt, where the government actually, you know, imploded because of this, because social media became this force to disrupt the political system. However, he points out that if you just think of democracy as a total democracy, yes, it succeeded, but in the sense of having democratic values or principles or a sense of continuity, the Arab Spring fucking failed, right? So Egypt is a great example where they, you know, there was enough of an uprising that the ruling government fell, but there wasn't really an organization to coherently claim power in Egypt or to organize things. The people who were the most organized were actually the Muslim Brotherhood. And so they took power, right? Essentially, you know, total democracy, everyone expressing, you know, lack of faith in the government was awesome. But all it did, it didn't create anything new. It was just a collective no from the people of the country through things like Facebook and Twitter and WhatsApp and through activism. So it basically destroyed the government, but it didn't actually create a new value system to replace it. And so what ended up happening was when the elections were finally called, the Muslim Brotherhood freaking killed that shit, even though, of course, a lot of the people who were big contributors in bringing down the government were liberal, westernized people who were very active on social media. And the idea is that, you know, when the rubble cleared, they couldn't actually collect power. What they could do was vote someone out, but they didn't really have the power to win elections because, you know, having an opinion is not the same as having a political party that is centrally planned and can coordinate things and can influence society and influence legislation. And I think, you know, in some ways, you know, even though that's Egypt and we can say, oh, that's Egypt and that's what's going on with them, and yeah, sure, they kicked everyone out, and, you know, and then these Muslim, you know, like the Muslim Brotherhood came in, and then after that there was a military coup that actually restored, you know, like the secular government. And again, you know, the people who were for total democracy probably weren't for the military coup and the installation of a general as the president. But I think there are analogies to what goes on in America, at least, right? Like, we have lots of people who are angry about a ton of issues. They say no to Washington. They say no to, you know, this conservative issue. They say no to this liberal issue. But they haven't established, you know, enduring political networks to organize on a grassroots level, to educate the public about these issues. A lot of it is, you know, is not about educating or reaching out to people or influencing the democratic process in sort of a constructive political competition sort of way that was, you know, say, imagined in the Constitution and, you know, in the Federalist Papers. A lot of it is just yelling at other people and shaming other people. And it's not about actually building political action. I remember that, you know, out of my friends that I know, one person I know who is on her phone, like, a lot. Yeah, I remember at one point I actually recommended, I was like, well, you know, considering you're so impassioned about all these issues, maybe you should consider, like, running for, like, you know, a local, to be a district representative, or, you know, at least a representative in the local, like, literally, not even city government in LA, but, like, your local district, you know, your community, you know, the local political representation for this district. Maybe you should consider running. And even though she had all these big ideas about politics in America, she didn't want to run. She didn't want to be involved in the meat and potatoes of democracy in the sense that it's a system of values. She wanted to be involved in the total democratic idea of we just vote on everything. And I'm just going to express my view. And expressing my view is the same as actually seeing something through, right? And so it's like, if I can just express my view and yell at people and shame friends, and yeah, we don't hang out that much anymore. But if I can do those things, then I have done my part in this democratic system. And of course, I made the point, you know, of saying, well, no, being in a democratic system means running for office and fundraising and getting to know your neighbors and understanding what their issues are and advocating for those issues. And she didn't want anything to do with that. And I get why she doesn't want to have anything to do with that. I don't want to have anything to do with that. That's a pain in the neck. I'd rather just rant on a microphone in my apartment. Like the fucking Unabomber. And but that's not democracy. That's not democracy in like the values and structure sense. That's democracy in the yelling sense. And a lot of people are good at the yelling part, but they're not good at the organization part. And if you're not good at the organization part, then you won't really actually be able to change things in society. I think that that is sort of Jaron Lanier's point fundamentally, is that if you can't come with political organization, then you'll just be beat by the savvy people who do have political organization. And, you know, he says it very in a very pithy way, and I do appreciate it. I'm just going to quote him. He says, "What social media did at that time and what it always does is create illusions that you can improve society by wishes alone, that the sanest people will be favored in cutting contests, and that somehow material well-being will just take care of itself. What actually happens always is that illusions fall apart when it is too late and the world is inherited by the crudest, most selfish, and least informed people. Anyone who isn't an asshole gets hurt the most." And that's a pretty harsh indictment of social media. I'm not sure if it totally bears out. And I will say it's interesting because I think he published this book at the beginning of 2018. Obviously, lots of things have happened. Or maybe he wrote it in 2017. I forget. Let me look it up, actually. Let me look at the information. Yeah, 2018. So what's interesting is like, right, I mean, obviously, what are things that have revved up? What are things that were already going on when this book went to press? Well, Me Too started in fall 2017. And is still going strong. And obviously, like, the Colin Kaepernick, like, the activism around him. Colin Kaepernick was not able to get back into the league in 2017. He had all these issues. You know, so at the time of the publication of this book, both those issues were going on. Now, in 2017, both those movements have had major victories, right? I mean, you know, recently, you know, the Les Moonves in CBS had to step down. Like Weinstein went down, that entire company imploded. Colin Kaepernick is now the face of the Nike campaign. And so it seems like, you know, from that perspective, it's like social media has been a wild success in these respects, actually. They've been, you know, yes, it isn't political organization and it isn't people, you know, creating political action committees or organizing on a community level or winning elections, but you know, these forces in expressing this anger in a total democracy sense, in the sense that the friend that I mentioned earlier, in the sense that she likes to express her political participation by expressing her point of view, has actually led to some pretty profound changes, at least in American society. But, you know, I think what Jaron might say to that, and, you know, he doesn't necessarily respond to that, but I'd say maybe what he might say to that is that profound changes are probably overstated. That's probably an exaggeration on my part. These are victories, certainly, in a process. But these are battles in actually like a larger war. Or you could say they're skirmishes in a larger campaign. These are moments in American society, but it doesn't necessarily predict where the trajectory is going, which is unknown. It's not clear that Me Too or all the Colin Kaepernick stuff will necessarily lead to the outcomes that people who are part of these movements really want. I mean, you know, I would say right now, looks like those movements are doing pretty well. But I will say, you know, a year ago, didn't necessarily look like they were. And, you know, the future is not done yet. You know, so I think he would say that maybe in some ways, you know, I think what he tries to argue in this chapter is essentially that some of these things, this expressive form of democracy where you just sort of say what you think and a lot of people say it and then shit will just change because enough people say that things need to change versus people organizing, you know, like what I said earlier, essentially political democracy, like organizational democracy versus expressive democracy is what I want to call those things. And the idea is that expressive democracy fundamentally doesn't work. It's really structural democracy that actually makes changes happen. And I would say right now, at least, it looks like actually expressive democracy is making a world of difference. But, you know, I think he might argue, yeah, is it really? Like, I mean, yes, Les Moonves went down. Yes, you know, a couple, you know, yes, Me Too highlighted sexual harassment as an issue. But fundamentally, it's not the Me Too hashtag that got Les Moonves out of his CEO position. It's not, you know, hashtag Me Too that got rid of Weinstein. It's the fact that those things created an environment where journalists, professional journalists, who are trained and diligent and really rigid in their research and their fact finding, were able to do work and get access to people who were bringing complaints. And so fundamentally, you know, journalism, investigative journalism especially, is a part of not expressive democracy, it is part of structural democracy, I think is one argument. And the other, so he would say maybe actually, you know, ultimately the reason this Me Too thing is taking off is because structural democracy has taken on these issues. So maybe expressive democracy sort of pointed out these issues, but now these issues are actually being integrated into the structural democratic process through, say, things like investigative journalism. I think he would also say that perhaps, you know, social media is actually undermining the availability of investigative journalism, as newspapers have to focus less on long-term, high-risk, high-reward, you know, investigative stories that may break something huge but take a lot of time and money and attention to cultivate. And, you know, newspapers have moved towards hot takes, which are low risk and really low reward for our society. So, you know, investigative journalism is a product of structural democracy, and it's also something that's being undermined by the presence of social media for reasons that he stated earlier in the book. So it's sort of a wash about whether the hashtags really make a difference or not. Similarly, you know, I do wonder with Colin Kaepernick even, is that really Colin Kaepernick's thing isn't about how he can't play in the NFL. Colin Kaepernick's thing at its core, you know, you can focus on the fact that Colin Kaepernick is being blackballed in the NFL. And I personally think he is. And I think that that is important for us to talk about. But maybe that misses the real issue, the issue that Colin Kaepernick kneeled about in the first place, which is that, you know, this is about, like, relationships between law enforcement and black communities. And the question is, sure, you know, Colin Kaepernick can be the face of Nike, but is that changing policing in black communities? If it's not, then it's expressive democracy, but it's actually not making an actual difference in practice. It's an illusion, as he describes. Social media creates illusions that you can improve society by wishes alone, and that somehow material well-being will take care of itself. And perhaps it's creating an illusion that things are getting better. I don't know, you know. We're not even at the end of 2018. So, you know, this book is less than a year old. It'll be interesting to see whether that argument bears out, that essentially expressive democracy is hot air. I don't really know. I'm sort of I sort of feel like when it comes to Me Too, you know, expressive democracy has been extremely successful. But ultimately, it's fed into, like I said, traditional investigative journalism and structural democracy. So in that way, social media can both highlight things and create a fertile environment for structural democracy to seize on. And actually, I think that that's sort of a, you know, I mean, maybe that's just me being a compromising, you know, hey, I just want to, split the difference. But I actually think that maybe that's actually the most healthy way that social media can work. It can be expressive, and then structural democracy follows it. Or a great example of this is like all these women who are running for political office in the wake of the Trump pussy grabbing thing. That became a big hashtag that motivated a lot of people to start running for office. That also motivated people to support women who are running for office. That's a really interesting intersection of both expressive democracy and structural democracy, as I've defined them. So, you know, I don't know if he's, I think it's hard to tell whether he's right or wrong about, you know, this, whether social media is making politics impossible. I will say that, of course, on the other side is, you know, while I may, you know, may be triumphing Kaepernick's success, or may triumph, Me too. There are the people on the other sides of these issues who also have their own hashtags and have their own point of view and have their own political organization. And, you know, we haven't really seen that yet. I feel like we're in the New Hope phase of things, and we got to see what happens when the Empire Strikes Back. It'll, you know, time will tell whether social media actually helps Net or not. He does give an interesting example, and I didn't mention this earlier, but I do think it is interesting that he talks about the idea that activists have big faith in social media, even though social media actually just uses their data, makes them fucking angry, ultimately makes money off them, and then also uses the images and the stuff that they come up with to show to the other side on the issue to antagonize them and get them heated up. So the idea is, you know, yes, we have Black Lives Matter, and Black Lives Matter is about policing in black communities. But the question is it actually making those communities safer? Are we actually getting better policing in those communities? Will this hashtag lead to better policing? And B, Black Lives Matter led to the hashtag All Lives Matter. And so essentially the debate became an argument between It became an argument about, you know, these phrases, and it's not really an argument about community policing anymore. And so social media has actually distracted us from the real issue. I don't know. I had an argument with someone who was more on the, or a discussion, I should say. I'm very diplomatic. But I had a discussion with someone who really didn't understand Black Lives Matter and is more on the All Lives Matter perspective and is more pro-police. It was clear that Black Lives Matter wasn't getting through to her, so it wasn't being effective in that sense. Now, you know, an argument can be made, and I think a pretty fair one, of is that really the purpose of Black Lives Matter? Is the purpose to persuade the other side, or is it simply to allow the people who are on this side of the issue to have something to organize around and to then enter political contests? And I will say that, you know, Philadelphia has an activist, a civil rights lawyer ran for DA and won. The same thing happened in a southern city, I think maybe St. Louis or Memphis or somewhere. And so in that ways, again, expressive democracy does lead to changes in structural democracy. And in that way, this can be a big victory. And maybe we will see changes in institutional policing over time. And social media certainly is responsible, I think, for, recent female candidates that have won in my home state of Virginia, for the person who won in New York, who knocked out, you know, Nancy Pelosi's number two. I forget what her name is. I think it's responsible for these black DAs who come from civil rights backgrounds, winning, and seeking political office, seeking to be a DA, and hopefully changing the way policing works. So social media may not be making politics impossible. It may be making them more antagonistic. But may, by making things more antagonistic, it doesn't necessarily mean that things are getting worse. Certainly things are getting worse between the Black Lives Matter and the All Lives Matter people. But in terms of amongst the Black Lives Matter people, things are actually getting better. That people are getting more organized. They're pooling resources. They're becoming more politically sophisticated. They're sharing resources. They're sharing mailing lists. So these things are big successes. And you could say social media is responsible for them. So, you know, the more and more I talk about this, the more and more I think, you know, I don't know. Maybe Jerron's, I think he might actually be wrong about the fact that social media is making politics impossible. There's no relationship between an increase, like you could have increased assholery online, but also more increased expressive democracy that leads to structural democracy changes. So, I don't know. I'm not as convinced about that. But I will say that, I think one of the points he does make that's interesting is he said during the 2016 election, there was a very famous account called Blacktivist, and everyone assumed it was a black activist who created the account, and it turns out it was actually run by a bunch of Russian, psychops hacker people, and the account was actually created to lower support for Clinton. So essentially, it was supposed to be, it was basically and to anger white voters into turning out who are conservative, and so in that case, you know, legitimately a fake account was at least intended. I don't know if it had that effect, but it was at least intended to make politics more difficult as opposed to actually moving politics forward, either in an expressive or a structural way. It was actually meant to retard expressive democracy and to impede Clinton's attempt at being a part of structural democracy. So, I don't know. I'm ambivalent about that one. But anyways, I don't know. I've been talking for like 2 hours at this point about all this stuff. But anyways, thank you for staying for the book report. And I hope you enjoyed it. The last point is just that social media hates your soul. You can read that chapter. I don't really think there's too much to say about that. I'm not really convinced by this point. But I just, you know, like, you should read it for yourself. I think it's sort of, you know, I feel like he wanted to make a listicle into a book. Speaking of hating social media, he made literally the title is 10 Arguments to Delete Your Social Media, and it's literally a listicle as a book. So, that shows the success of Upworthy and things like that. But yeah, no, it's interesting. I mean, I think my overall takeaway from it, especially now having talked it out, and I read the book and I talked about it with friends, but talking about it on this podcast has been really fun and allowed me to like open up my brain and really think about this stuff. I think overall, I think on a micro level, I will say that maybe on a macro level, social media is a success. But certainly on a micro level, I do feel like it is a failure. And I could still feel like it's a failure while believing on a macro level it is a success. It certainly has, on a micro level, generated some really great conversations. You know, I was up until 1:30 in the morning yesterday talking with a friend who is a black woman about the hashtag Black Girl Magic and what it means, you know, and what that represents. And, it, you know, the hashtag, you know, I was just talking, like, what does this hashtag mean? I don't really get it. It seems self-important. And it gave an opportunity for her to explain, yeah, you know what, society, especially America, shits on black women a lot. And they have a really tough time. And she's like, as a black woman, I'm just made to feel lesser than. And Black Girl Magic isn't this idea that, like, I'm a magical black woman, everything I do is perfect. It's the idea that, like, I can triumph by being myself. The goal isn't to assimilate. The goal is to be myself and succeed as a black woman and not change anything, not change myself a smidge, but go after what's important to me and be successful. And that's what black magic, black girl magic means to her. Not black magic woman, totally different. That's a different thing. And I thought that that was a really interesting point. And, you know, I wouldn't have that conversation with that hashtag. And I don't think she would have been as willing to talk about it. I wouldn't have been as willing to ask about it had it not been for that hashtag. So, you know, maybe in some cases these hashtags even create micro interactions that are very positive. So, you know, hey, if most of it is, you know, if I have, you know, 15 shitty interactions and I have one good one, you know, maybe it is worth it. Democracy is a sweat equity, proposition, you could say. It's maybe perhaps so is social media. Anyways, thanks for being here and, I'll talk to you soon. Bye. So there's a little bonus part I realize that I forgot to say, which is, I mean, overall, what are my conclusions about this book? You know, it makes these arguments to delete your social media account. And at least for me, speaking for myself, I think they, except for Instagram, where I can see my nieces and I can put up photos and information about shows, I think it makes sense. For at least for me, it did convince me that, you know, I deleted Facebook back in March 2018, and I think this, reading this book for the most part, you know, convinced me that that was probably the right thing for me. You know, I don't necessarily need to be knowing what's on everyone's mind every day. I sort of need to be peering more in my own head and in my own creative space. I think some of the things he said about creativity and the idea that it has to exist sort of within yourself and outside of judgment really resonated with me. I thought that that was like a really sensible point. And the idea that, you know, the social media preys on your insecurities and your addictive tendencies, I think is very, you know, I think that's accurate. And so, you know, for me, I think Facebook and Twitter are sort of, for the most part, a no-go. Maybe I'll use them for specifically for promotional purposes, but otherwise I won't use them. Also, you know, one big takeaway for me coming out of this book was even being on Instagram, that I would have a private Instagram account where I put up goofy photos of myself for my family and, you know, to keep up with people and keep up with people I personally know and have a personal relationship with. And then I would have another Instagram where I just, you know, have all my, you know, it's purely for some professional purpose and having very clear lines and boundaries around what each thing is for is very healthy and important. So I understand why I'm on this thing, you know, even if I'm on Instagram or even if I'm on Twitter maybe one day, or say I'm back on Facebook, that I'm on it with a very specific purpose, and so I don't get caught up in some of the other shit that's floating around, which I'm not as crazy about. I think the book was really powerful for, it confirmed some of my feelings and helped me understand exactly why I felt a certain way about a lot of situations. And it wasn't all about, you know, isolating or disconnecting from people. In some ways, the book is about taught me about maybe better ways to connect with people or understand the impediments to connecting with people and maybe me coming up with my own solutions about how to get around that. So, you know, all in all, I think I really do agree with the book's prescriptions. Again, on the macro level, I'm not convinced that it is correct, but it certainly, you know, has a lot of, I think, very, like, wise things to say, and certainly has helped me understand both myself better and my addictive relationship with social media, as well as helping me understand the other ways that I have to, you know, understand or assume that other people are approaching social media so I can make better decisions about interacting with them. So yeah, I don't know. I just, you know, I think it was a great book and I think there's a lot to learn. It's a pretty short read and I'd highly encourage, you know, reading it. Especially if anything I said in this podcast episode interested you, you know, make these decisions for yourself about where social media fits in your life. I think even if you decide not to delete your social media, I think it'll just help you understand it better. It certainly helped me understand social media better, considering how much time and fretting I have put into it in the past, and I'm sure I will be putting into it in the future. Like, you know, it's fucking beautiful. It's a great book, and at least thought-provoking, and, you know, will give you a new perspective on your own life, and you can choose what the fuck to do with it. So, yeah. Anyways, just my last thoughts. Bye.